Welcome everyone to this second podcast in our three-part series on investigations. My name is Maria Struss and I'm a partner in the Farrow & Co. safeguarding unit and employment team, and I co-lead Farrow's investigations unit. In part one of this series, we looked at sexual misconduct in quite some detail. We looked at the national landscape 10 years on from Jimmy Savile, several months on from the murder of Sarah Everard. We considered what organisations should be doing, how they can detect any pre-offending behaviour, and looked at the types of organisations where sexual offending can occur. In this next episode of the series, we look at the detail of carrying out an investigation, including the key information needed at the beginning, the disclosure process that can happen when someone is making a disclosure or an allegation of this type of misconduct, an investigation plan, and looking at, having a robust structure around an investigation process. My guest speakers on the podcast are Gary Pankhurst and Peter Spindler, two former very senior police who specialised in investigations into this type of crime and problem for very many years. Do listen to episode one when you get the chance. Thank you. I'm going to come to Gary now because I think it would be interesting to get into a little bit more maybe of the nitty-gritty of an investigation into some of these types of conduct, Gary. And if we think, you know, my motivation for doing the podcast really was to learn all of the good things from the criminal justice system to help HR and safeguarding leads improve the quality of investigations into these complex issues.
Yeah.
And I guess, Gary, if we break down an investigation and an organization into the absolute basics, it's, you know, allegation, disclosure, complaint, call it what you will, comes in. HR are assessing the information in front of them. And as we've said earlier, you know, it would seem to me to be important to be assessing, is it something potentially criminal? And you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would be, you know, putting a call into the police maybe for some advice if you think it is criminal, or talking to your lawyers as well, obviously. HR then moving to establish an investigation, unless it's something that has been investigated elsewhere by the police or local authority or regulator or something like that. Appointing an investigator, agreeing a methodology in terms of reference, all that important groundwork for kind of planning an investigation, having a provisional timetable, and then looking at gathering evidence, be it digital, documentary, and who you're going to interview, analysing the evidence and preparing the report. That's very basic, obviously. From the start, Gary, what I'm wondering what, you know, you would say in your, you know, many years of experience of handling the most complex of investigations, what are the key things to get right in an investigation, how to get it onto the right footing, and thereafter, what, you know, any thoughts on what might be the pitfalls and common things, common problems to avoid?
I guess the first one is to say that, you know, potentially there is no such thing as the perfect investigation. And one of the ways that you become a, you know, I won't say better, more experienced investigator is because you have learned by the things that you've got wrong in the past, or the things that have gone wrong. One of the first lessons for me is, as you quite rightly say, is one of the, probably the primary points is the assessment when you first get that information. Because depending on when the report comes in, you know, particularly if it's in a fairly recent to the point of the event that has been complained about, you may, nothing ever gets better with time. You know, as time goes on, information disappears or becomes harder to retrieve, everything becomes more difficult. So that, to that extent, nothing is going to get better than where you are when you start. You know, you're going to learn more information, but you need to be sure that everything you can get is there to start with. So the very first thing is to assess what it is that you want to know. So as you've quite rightly said, what are we actually dealing with? So you need to have the requisite individual to be able to assess that. They've got to have the correct skills and training and knowledge to know what they've got. Because if you haven't got that, then you're going to start from the wrong place. And generally what that means is it just goes further away from where it needs to be. Because there's this sort of thing called escalation of error. And it's generally particularly problematic in the early stages of an inquiry, where if there is a wrong assessment of a piece of information or evidence or from a witness, but that becomes written into the narrative as you carry on, it may not be discovered for some considerable time, and yet it can be very important. So we need to make that first assessment right. From that, it's what do we actually know? What do we want to find out? And how solid is that information that we've got? So generally, it may be secondhand in the fact that by the time the complaint gets to us, it's highly unlikely that the first person we will speak to, if we're an investigator, is going to be the individual that's made the complaint. It will have come through. So we just need to know what that chain is. That's a start point. And I always found within criminal investigations that a really, really good source of information was that initial 999 call. Very often there was information in that we didn't know or hadn't been transmitted in the chain through to by the time an inquiry starts, sometimes vital. An example that I think of was a murder case that we were dealing with where the mother of the victim phoned up from the scene. She was actually phoning for an ambulance at the time. And about a minute into the call, she speaks to somebody else. In the first few hours of the inquiry, nobody knew that there was another person in the address at the time. Turns out this person was responsible. And that came out, and we proved that from that initial 999 call. So always go back to source.
Translating that for the kind of HR and safeguarding leads, Gary, I would suggest that is, you know, whoever's taken the initial disclosure, making, you know, detailed notes afterwards and making sure those are in the files. That's about good record keeping, isn't it? In our context, where there's not so much like recorded calls to go on. Well, there may be, but, you know, more likely it'll have been a conversation or an email. But yeah. I think that's a good point, is looking carefully at the information originally that came in.
And not to summarize too quickly. I think that's the thing, is that if you are the person who is speaking to that original complaint, don't summarize it and move it on. Try and use the same words that you received in the complaint and ensure that the message is accurate as you pass it on. Because otherwise, it's impossible to make that assessment from sound information as you start to develop. So what we need to know to start with is, first of all, what has happened, if anything. If it has, then where did it fall? And that's where the knowledge comes in terms of, is it potentially criminal? If it's not, is it, who within an organisation should have responsibility for looking into it further? And what policies are potentially being breached? So we need to be clear on that, because that is what's going to set the boundaries of the investigation that you move into.
And I would chip in there, Gary, that what, you know, is helpful for, you know, the HR or safeguarding leads, whoever's taking the disclosure, is to know the kind of immediate do's and don'ts. You know, what do you not say and what do you say? In response to those sort of immediate disclosures, so for example, things like not promising confidentiality, which can't really be promised in many contexts, and explaining, you know, in a transparent way what will happen next.
Yeah,
and offering them support.
It's a really valuable point, because one of the key things, particularly when we're dealing with anything that may be sexual in nature, in terms of a complaint, is that there will have been a thought process that's gone through before that person has made the decision to come forward. And that may involve also who they have decided to come forward to. And that's a really important point. So this is not just a case of, it's really difficult, for example, if you pick the phone up and all of a sudden you're confronted with something you weren't necessarily expecting. You may have, you know, five or six other things going on. But the fact is that there is a really important reason this person has chosen this point to make this complaint. And they may have been thinking about it for a long time. And if they don't get the right response, that can shut that down completely and they could end up not moving forward with it. You may only get that one opportunity. So it is really important. As you say, Maria, we can't be offering confidentiality. It would be entirely inappropriate, but what we can do is reassure the individual as to the process that we will be gone through, because I think generally what they're looking for is reassurance, one, that they're going to be listened to, taken seriously, and that the matter will be taken forward with them having some element of control. Because I think the difficulty comes is that one of the reasons so many people choose not to speak about things that have happened to them is because while it's their secret, they hold control of that. And so it provides them with some form of security. Whereas once they've told somebody else, then it puts them in a vulnerable position and they need to trust that other individual is going to deal with that information in a sensitive and appropriate way. And that can be quite difficult, particularly if perhaps in the past that hasn't been the case.
I would chip in and add, you know, as well, to kind of take one of your points further, that there's a whole host of reasons why people are nervous about coming forward with anything, be it the kind of more, you know, civil equality law harassment or the more, you know, the more potential criminal sexual misconduct. Could be they're worried about the impact on their careers. They're worried about, you know, some form of reprisal from the person they're accusing. They may be, you know, HR can seem like a bit of a big, scary thing that's a bit far away. And well, they're not, maybe they don't really have information about what might happen next. And as you say, I think an excellent point, they may be afraid of losing control. And it's also, and I wonder if you would share this thought, you know, it's certainly been my experience that sometimes when people come forward with one disclosure, they're testing the water to see the reaction of the organization, and then maybe a bit more of the story comes out, which doesn't mean that, you know, they're not credible witnesses or they're making a false allegation. It just means they're building up confidence, perhaps, to make a more fulsome disclosure. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I would absolutely agree with that. And certainly it was a regular pattern, particularly when you were dealing with children. Quite often children will make a very clear decision on whether or not they trust that individual to go further. So they will often only make a really, you know, a minor disclosure, or they won't say very much. And it's if that disclosure is not dealt with very well, then they may not say any more. And I absolutely agree with that, that it really can't be taken at face value. That first conversation is incredibly important.
Gary, I'm going to ask you in a minute if you'll take us back to, because we've gone off on a very interesting tangent, but I'm going to ask you to take us back in a moment to looking at that, you know, investigations and what helps to set it on the right footing. But I just thought I'd give Peter the opportunity to jump in.
Thanks. And I think what the two of you have just done is show how important the use of language is when dealing with these issues right from the outset. And it's interesting you're using that word confidential and confidentiality. I tend to advise people to say we cannot keep this secret, but we will treat it as confidential. However, there is a duty to share. In the safeguarding world, there is a duty to work in partnership. And key thing is that person must leave that first meeting recognizing that they're being taken seriously, that they're being listened to. I would hesitate to use the word being believed. However, all of the work around victims of sex offences shows the key thing for them is they just want to be believed, because all too often we're existing in a culture of denial and disbelief around this topic. And that is the biggest inhibitor to reporting. Now, you can get yourself tied up in knots if you're saying to someone, yes, I believe you. But what you do want to be doing is reassuring them that it's going to be taken seriously.
What might help actually is if I quickly explain, I'm glad you raised the point about confidentiality, Peter, because it's a key one. And we've seen so much in the press about the use of non-disclosure agreements and gagging orders and so on. If I just explain to our listeners that generally speaking, all workplace investigations should be treated as confidential processes, which in short means that the identity and the facts of the allegation and the investigation are kept on a strictly need-to-know basis. Now, the caveat to that is, if you have legal or regulatory obligations to report issues, then that would override the confidentiality. So for example, in your example, you know, if you think a child has been harmed by the conduct of an adult, you would be reporting that to the local authority designated officer and the police. The other scenario where you may override confidentiality in a workplace investigation would be, taking it slightly away from child protection, would be where you think that someone's immediate risk, the immediate risk to someone's safety and welfare, or the safety and welfare of a third party. I think HR teams would be justified in overriding confidentiality to protect someone from some kind of imminent harm in that scenario. So I just hope that clears up a little bit about confidentiality. Quite a tricky concept. It comes up a lot in workplace investigations, as does anonymity, but that's a slightly different topic and they often get conflated. Gary, I'm going to come back to you in relation to, you know, thinking about what are the things to get right? How do we get these investigations right, and what can we learn? I think you'd reach the assessment of the information that's come to you point, and there's no doubt a few more factors to throw in.
Yeah, I think the important thing is not to get, you've got to go through a reasoned decision-making process, but it's also important to move into action. And I think sometimes there can be this, particularly if there's a lot of information, this sort of, I don't want to miss anything, I want to be able to go through it all minutely. And as long as you have a structured way of approaching it, then it doesn't matter how big or small the inquiry is, you should be able to identify the gaps and the actions that you need to do. So it's really about having a systematic process by which you can assess what you've got, and also to be aware of your own situation. So what I mean by that is to think about how you make decisions. That we all think that we go through all the information in a careful way, balancing it all up, look at all the options, and then choose the best option. And actually, that generally isn't what we do. So it's really important to work out whether you are balancing things up properly. And so the best way to make sure that you get through that is by potentially setting yourself up with a grid or a structure by which you start to put together what you've got. And then, so you're really identifying your investigative plan, and that brings in all these strategies. And if we come back to the recording, which is such an important part, you as an investigator, once you've made that initial assessment, it's really important that you record where you are at that time. And I don't mean not physically, but I mean, what do you know? What do you think has happened? What decisions are you making now, and on what basis? Because as that investigation develops, that will change. And particularly if it becomes different from how it might first appear. And within sexual cases, that can quite often happen for exactly the reasons that you've mentioned, Maria, that if somebody comes forward with a complaint that may on the surface appear to be a one-off incident, you know, maybe a minor incident that's taken place in the office that didn't involve any contact and what have you, you may think you're dealing with one thing, And then actually, as that starts to develop, you could find that it could be a course of conduct, it could be other people drawn into it. So you don't know where it's gonna go. And I think that's really important to have a robust structure, not only of how you go about the actions within the investigation, but also so that you can go back, track back, and see how things have changed in terms of your thinking about where you are. Because early in the investigation, you're going to be information poor. And so you should have a very open mind as to the potential outcomes. But as you develop that investigation and the information and evidence starts to build up, then you should be in a position to start saying, right, of all the different hypotheses that I might have thought about at the beginning of this, we can discount those few because of this, and it really has come down to maybe one or two things. So by the time you come towards the conclusion, hopefully you've removed the gaps in knowledge that you had at the start of the investigation. So that's really how you want to move through the investigation process. And there are many different ways to structure that, but having a kind of a day book and a working diary of how you go about the actions in your investigation and recording. A lot of people get it wrong because all they do is actually just record what they did, which is helpful, but it doesn't help you when it comes down to why you make decisions, why it's defensible, why you decided to do one thing, even more important, why you decided not to do something.
Yeah,
those decisions are really important.
I could absolutely see how that recording could, you know, is a real tip here for our, you know, HR and safeguarding professionals listening, recording the rationale and the reasons why actions were taken or not taken. It's not something that gets done routinely in workplace investigations, but can be really helpful if you're in a tribunal or something defending the dismissal of someone. And it's increasingly common now that you would record reasons for suspension and have all of that thought process mapped out on the file. Now, Gary, that's really helpful in terms of, you know, thinking about an investigation plan and, you know, evaluating and assessing the evidence as it's coming in and what more you need. And there's some easy wins there, isn't there? You know, as you were saying, if you're looking at a supposedly one-off behaviour, I mean, in my experience, it's not going to be a one-off. You know, people just don't out of the blue commit some act of harassment or assault or something. There's generally other flags and concerning behaviors, isn't there? And an easy win is looking back at their HR personnel file.
It's really interesting you say that, Marie, because that kind of goes back to when Peter was talking about the different types of offender behavior. We could look at it and go, well, it's really interesting for us, but you know, it doesn't really help us in an investigative stance. Actually, it really, really does, because it's that peripheral and background information that you start to gather that builds that picture that if you do understand the way that somebody behaves who may be utilising their position in order to sexually harass, then that behaviour will start to become apparent. Just a very quick example of somebody that I dealt with, he was a fixated paedophile. Well, he went through school and training, university, and he trained to be an engineer. But the difficulty with being an engineer is it doesn't give you access to what his sexual interest was, which was young boys. And so at the age of late 20s, he retrained to become a teacher, which gave it, and then he went and worked in a boys' school, which then gave him the access that he'd clearly wanted for many years. And we found this out from the material that we found in his house. But even then, when he was at the school, there was no overt offending, and we found very little in the end. It came to light from some what would have been termed low-level grooming behaviour when he was away, but it was more about what was found as a result of the arrest. But the thing was, this took years to develop, and those cues were there. You know, he started to develop really close friendships with a very small particular group of boys. He started to run computer clubs where he was on his own with boys. All of the parents said, oh, he's wonderful with the boys. He spends so much of his time. And And of course he did, because he loved spending time with them, and he would slowly be cultivating the environment where he could be trusted by everybody around him.
And slowly then, no doubt, pushing those boundaries and testing the rules of the organisation to see how far could he go before someone would pick him up that he wasn't quite acting in the, you know, expected way, and so on. And I guess I would add for those listening, think about if something has come into you, which certainly could do, that is criminal in nature, and you know, a person is now a sort of an accused and a suspect in the criminal justice system, that doesn't stop you as an employer investigating the spectrum of other behaviour like bullying and harassment and the sort of more civil behaviours, which you might find if you start your own investigation, obviously in consultation with, you know, the authorities, like the police who might be investigating the criminal stuff and ensuring that you don't do anything that overlaps or prejudices some kind of criminal inquiry. But parallel investigations are possible and happen quite regularly, actually, and can be done with the right care. Peter?
Yeah, just to wrap that one up, I mean, I would say don't just focus on the sort of sexual behaviour, sexual misconduct type area. Have a look at the corporate credit card. Have a look at the email usage, yeah, all the things that you can do from within the company, because often these individuals aren't just breaking the rules in one part of the business. You know, these are the people, as you rightly say, that are always pushing the boundaries. And Gary had a fantastic phrase that he used in the recent ITV documentary on Savile, where he talked about normalizing the abnormal. You know, it won't come as any great surprise to colleagues on the shop floor, on the workplace, when those individuals are brought to book. And I think the key thing is to create this culture where people can spot these behaviours, so they need educating in the workplace, and that you've given them sufficient pathways and permission to report and bring it to notice. And that will make a lot of difference in the culture of our organisations.
So it's about detecting these behaviours rather than simply relying on people to come forward, but creating an environment where they can come forward in a safe and supported and managed way, and where the response is also proportionate, and it's not that sort of knee-jerk, we're just going to sack this person, because that can have a real chilling impact on a workforce, which is why we're talking about investigating these behaviours and not just taking a kind of knee-jerk reaction.
Interestingly enough, we could use the terms that are prevalent in other areas, which is, you know, we're probably all familiar with the term insider threat, for example, and creating a hostile environment within an organisation against things like fraud. But it's not so prevalent to think of it in the terms of, you know, conduct like that. And yet actually that those individuals can present just as much of a threat. Yes, it's the individuals, but it is also to the organisation as a whole. And I think that's where promoting an open culture of being assured and willing to come forward with concerns, because it is the lower level behaviour that is that the attempt to normalise the behaviour that is not right. So, you know, we see it time and time again in all forms, where somebody will do things that they can talk their way off. You know, that if somebody objects to it, then they go, oh, sorry, that problem there, and they'll move on to somebody else. The fact is that if we see that and we think, well, we're not happy with that. In the past, it may have been the case that people wouldn't think to say anything because it just didn't seem that serious. Or if somebody looks uncomfortable, you know, because somebody's over their shoulder, that kind of thing, looking at the computer screen and, you know, the hand on the back of the chair, the sort of things like that within an office environment that at first glance may or may not be an issue. But like you say, we all know the individuals where it is an issue, actually. That this is a kind of behaviour that they're just, as you say, just testing the boundaries all the time.
And I think one of the things the pandemic has shown us, prevention is far better than cure.
Absolutely. That is the end of the second part of our conversation on investigations. I hope you find it useful. Do tune in next week when we'll be exploring interviewing techniques in some more detail with Gary Pankhurst. Thank you.